Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we'll speak with Sharona Coots. She's the Vice President of Investigations at Rewire News, and she'll talk about the nexus between religious conservatism and white supremacy. This is not a new thing, by the way. Then we'll be joined by Eliza Newland Carney from The American Prospect to talk about Steve Bannon's all-out war with the so-called establishment and the grifters who have kind of jumped on his bandwagon for fun and profit. And finally, we'll be joined by John Amato from Crooks and Liars to talk about the fight Donald Trump started with the pregnant widow of a soldier who died on his watch. Trump's watch, not John Amato's. And speaking of Bannon, one of the more offensive aspects of Donald Trump's presidency, of Bannonism, if you will, is making me agree with George W. Bush, the second worst president in modern times. Did you catch Shrub's speech this week? Bannon did, by the way. And he unloaded on Trump, on Bush in response. George W.'s talk was a rare one. He doesn't venture out into public much. One of the smarter decisions he's made, I think. But here are a few highlights, and note that he never mentions Trump by name.
Bigotry seems emboldened. Our politics seems more vulnerable to conspiracy theories and outright fabrication. Argument turns too easily into animosity. Disagreement escalates into dehumanization. Too often we judge other groups by their worst examples, while judging ourselves by our best intentions. Our identity as a nation, unlike many other nations, is not determined by geography or ethnicity, by soil or blood. We become the heirs of Martin Luther King Jr. by recognizing one another not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. This means that people of every race, religion, ethnicity can be fully and equally American. It means that bigotry or white supremacy in any form is blasphemy against the American creed.
And here's a bit of Steve Bannon's response in an address to the California Republicans on Friday.
President Bush, to me, embarrassed himself. Speechwriter wrote a highfalutin speech. It's clear he didn't understand anything he was talking about. He equates the Industrial Revolution, the Agricultural Revolution, globalization. He has no earthly idea whether he's coming or going. Just like it was when he was President of the United States.
Oof. You know, I'd feel some schadenfreude. Maybe I'd pop some proverbial popcorn. But here's the thing. Bannonism, Trumpism, is far more dangerous than Bush's cronyism, at least domestically. And at least 17 years after the World Trade Centers came down, Bush was obviously extraordinarily dangerous at that moment. And Bannonism, white ethno-nationalism, clearly has the upper hand in one of our two major parties. I mean, this was clear this week. So here we have Bush decrying conspiracy theories and racist dog whistles, but he's out of politics. He's not running for anything. Ed Gillespie, his former advisor, is. He's running for the governor of Virginia, and his campaign is just a model of racist demagoguery. His basic campaign message is that scary Latinos are going to rape your daughter. That's what he's running on. Anyway, we've got a big show, so let's jump to it. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Sharona Coots.
Wicked! We're early in the morning, but sometimes when it's late, I can't wait to call my baby in the 718. But just the other day, you know, we had an argument. The kind you finish, can't remember where you started at. My head was bugging and I couldn't wait to finish it. Talking on the phone, so long my ear was getting wet. Know how it is, no need to share all my bills. The voices got raised, conversation got crazed. with something about exes. Got no way of hexing relationships. I better get some Oprah tips. So to my baby,
it's where the love goes.
She drive me crazy. So to my baby,
it's where the love goes.
Sometimes she drive me crazy. Say to my baby,
it's where the love goes.
She drive me crazy. Say to my baby,
it's where the love goes.
Why does every woman have to make a man crazy?
There's always static blowing up in my face. The alcoholic down the hall be telling me turn down my bass. So don't be surprised, they're gonna be burning and shooting and looting tonight. Lord. At times like this I reminisce about before our first kiss. She keep on passing me by, and I will keep on wishing that maybe someday she will come my way, and I will get to know her and show her my Marvin Gaye collection, or maybe a few of my best Al Green selections, and ride her to my crib and into my kitchen. I'll be her host and we toast some MD 2020, the poor man's Moet before you get your money. But just then I might take a solo. She couldn't hear me, but if she wants to, then she...
Welcome back. This is Politics and Reality Radio. I am Joshua Holland, and I'm pleased to be joined by Sharona Coots. She is Rewire's Vice President of Investigations. Sharona, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. Sharona had a piece this week at Rewire.news titled "New Analysis Shows Supporters of Family Research Council Embrace White Supremacy and Neo-Nazism." Sharona, why don't you give us the short version of this analysis that you conducted, and then we'll kind of dig into the details.
Sure. So essentially, we're interested to know how it is that, you know, this coalition of Trump supporters, which essentially seems to be most strongly supported by two groups, the, you know, conservative Christians, as they call themselves, and then you have the people on the outright. We wanted to know, you know, how is it that these two groups hang together, and what sort of things do they have in common? And we figured out certain ways to drill into that question. And what we found was that a lot of what they have in common centers around a sort of white supremacist notion of the family.
And you undertook to kind of quantify this using Twitter, right?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So basically, you know, there's a lot of anecdotes that show instances where you have the head of the Family Research Council, which is one of the most prominent groups in the, you know, radical right wing of the evangelical movement. So you have a lot of instances where Tony Perkins is speaking on Breitbart News and talking with hosts there about how their audiences are mostly the same people. But I wanted to see if we could get beyond anecdotes and actually dig into some data. So we crunched the numbers on more than 500,000 Twitter accounts and came up with some what seems to be fairly compelling proof that there really is a significant overlap between these two groups, or that, in fact, they're the same group.
I think that that's actually the better way to put it. And so I guess in one sense, now let me just first ask, so Tony Perkins, the head of the FRC, he's also had direct associations with white supremacists, is that right?
Yeah, he has. The Southern Poverty Law Center has done some great work on just cataloging his history of associating with overt white supremacists. He had a history down in Louisiana of working with a congressman who ended up hiring a firm run by David Duke to do his, campaign messaging. And that caused a real stir down there because essentially voters were getting robocalls that had David Duke's name attached to them on behalf of this congressman. He's also spoken at events run by overtly white supremacist groups. So he certainly has his own outright history of associating with white supremacists, though in more recent years, you know, every photograph you see of him, basically, he's in a suit and, you know, crisply ironed collar, tie, presents very much as a man of God. You know, it's the politics of respectability at its height with Perkins in recent years. And certainly the sort of revelation that a lot of his followers are the same people who follow the likes of Richard Spencer would not be something that he would have, I imagine, if he'd talked to me, I would have imagined that he would have, probably tried to distance himself from that.
So so your analysis found that about just under 20% of Perkins' followers also follow one of the stars of the kind of new white supremacist movement, Jared Taylor, Richard Spencer, you mentioned, Mike Cernovich, these kind of alt-right people who are also, by the way, trying to mainstream these rather old white supremacist concepts. pardon me. In one sense, this overlap isn't surprising, right? Because I'm sure that 20% of people on the left who care deeply about, say, reproductive rights and follow Rewire also would follow, say, the Economic Policy Institute or whatever other progressive groups you might name. They probably also follow environmental groups, for example, right? So these are, there should be some overlap between right-wing groups and just as there is to left-wing groups, but it does speak to the controversy over whether the Family Research Council is a hate group, right? Tell us a little bit about that and about FRC's campaign to marginalize the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yeah, it's really important. So basically, I think most people are familiar with the Southern Poverty Law Center. The United States' leading nonprofit that tracks hate groups and, you know, extremist individuals. And they're highly regarded. They started off basically with an intention to defeat the Klan in the South, and to a very large extent, they succeeded. I mean, not entirely, but they were very effective because what they realized was that they could, you know, basically sue individual Klansmen for the damage that they caused through their actions. So basically, they made it financially painful to commit hate crimes. And so fast forward a few decades, they, you know, remain one of the nation's leading groups studying this stuff. And it's incredibly important right now when we've got a surge of hate activity. A few years ago, the Southern Poverty Law Center designated the Family Research Council a hate group, largely because of their continuous vilification of LGBTQ people. They consistently make false claims, lies, along the lines of gay men in particular being pedophiles. But, you know, more broadly, this hate rhetoric, which is always couched in religious terms about homosexuality being sinful and bad and wrong. And so based on that, they were categorized as a hate group. That designation is very inconvenient for them because it scares funders. It turns away funders, and they are a non-profit organization.
Right.
You know, so they really don't like that. So that's part of why they are at the moment fighting back against the Southern Poverty Law Center. But the bigger picture as well is that it can detract from their messages, you know, that they, you know, in terms of winning the policy debates that they're involved in. They're very against abortion. They're very against marriage equality, all these things. So they've gotten together with almost 50 other groups on the far right, and these include virulent anti-Mexican groups, virulent anti-Muslim groups, And they are, they've written letters to media organizations claiming that the Southern Poverty Law Center is biased and shouldn't be trusted as a source. The bigger picture here, Josh, as you well know, is a new fight over what it means to agree on facts, what it means to be objective, who are the arbiters of truth, if any. It's sort of a subset of the broader attack on the news media. So what they're really doing, you know, the way, you know, we think about, you know, we might say in Australia is instead of, you know, playing the ball, they're playing the man.
Right.
You know, they instead of trying to win the policy argument here, they're trying to hobble their opponent. And so, you know, one of the reasons that I was interested in trying to get some actual data was to say, okay, is there any evidence that they are a hate group? And I think that our findings are really important because what it shows is that almost a fifth of all of the people who follow Tony Perkins on Twitter are also interested and receptive to the ideas of someone like Richard Spencer, who, you know, he's not just a white supremacist. I think what's really important to understand about someone like Richard Spencer or Jared Taylor is they're what's called white nationalists. Now, that's a very sanitized term. A white nationalist is someone who believes that there should only be white people in this country. There is no way to achieve that without some kind of genocidal action.
Right. Right, he calls for nonviolent ethnic cleansing. Yeah,
that's like saying nonviolent rape. It's a contradiction in terms. I'm sorry, you cannot have a nonviolent ethnic cleansing. That doesn't exist. And you've got forced deportations. You've got splitting up families. You've got depriving people of fundamental rights. You know, it just doesn't exist. These are extremely dangerous people.
But it also, on another level, it denies the Americanness of people who are not white. And that is equally as outrageous. I mean, you're not going to, obviously, it's not a viable policy proposal. But beyond that, it others, you know, a very large share of American citizens who have been here since before it was a country, who fought in the Revolutionary War and the Civil War and the War of 1812 and both World Wars. You know, this idea that whiteness is synonymous with Americanism is equally pernicious, perhaps less violent, but equally pernicious. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Sharona Coots. I don't know what it means to play the ball, not the game, but I think that that's to work the refs. And I'll say this, as an American, whatever you say with an Australian accent sounds authoritative to me.
Well, that's extremely misleading.
So, let me ask you this. To what degree are these movements tied by the idea of white genocide? You know, you have the religious right saying abortion is murder. They oppose, obviously, reproductive rights for everybody, but you know that there's a sense that it challenges their idea of traditional white womanhood. Speak to this angle a little bit, the white genocide angle.
I think that's one of the two significant factors that not just bring these two groups together, but mean that in many ways they are coming together as one. So there's this myth of white genocide that, you know, immigration, and they don't mean white immigration, they mean people who are not white coming to this country, or, you know, there are very strong movements in different parts of Europe, and what they mean is that, you know, there's going to be racial blending. And it's just unbelievable that we're talking in these terms, because we went through World War II, you know, but we are. So, you know, you hear exactly the sort of Nazi rhetoric with new words, but it's about, you know, the idea of these breeders, these, you know, non-white people who come in and they have a higher rate of reproduction than white women. And they sort of, that's you know, when you hear someone like Tony Perkins talk about family values, I just encourage listeners to think, whose family, what kind of values? And by all accounts, it's a very white, very misogynistic view of the family. The other thing that brings them together is misogyny, and particularly that's why we see one area of almost total agreement between white supremacists and the evangelicals who follow someone like Tony Perkins, is opposition to abortion. They don't want white women to work. Recently, we've heard Richard Spencer even questioning whether white women should be able to vote, or yes, any women should be able to vote. And they don't want women to have control over their lives and their bodies. And so that is, and let me just say this. I imagine that, you know, a lot of people listening to this are thinking, yeah, but I follow a bunch of people actually because I disagree with them. You know, I follow people whose ideas and opinions I find loathsome, and I want to know what they're saying. And that's absolutely valid. And for that reason, I spent 2 weeks doing very little other than combing through hundreds of these accounts. And so I can tell you, I found a handful of these accounts that were like reporters like me.
Sure.
Who follow, you know, these hate groups. And I found some that seemed to be bots, you know, like accounts that were established, you know, a year ago, but have tweeted like 200,000 times. So that were the minority. The vast majority are people who have a couple of thousand followers or just a few hundred, but are retweeting memes that show African Americans as, you know, apes, show, you know, Mexicans as also basically like animal looking, have jokes about, you know, pictures of Jews in ovens, also the sort of most horrible, like hooked nose, you know, leering figures, you know, Muslims as rape, like everything, you know, all the most offensive stuff. It's people who follow Tony Perkins who also follow Richard Spencer or Gavin McInnes or Mike Cernovich or Jared Taylor. Not only are they retweeting a lot of this stuff, it's with like laughing emojis or that green Pepe frog or, you know, comments that will then sort of say like build the wall, you know, hashtag MAGA, that sort of stuff. So you just couldn't mistake the fact that they were enthusiastically spreading these hateful messages. And it's not just that they're hateful, they are very dangerous. So it wasn't just simply that they were following them because they wanted to keep tabs on them.
It wasn't academic for most of them. Let me ask you this, Sharona. How many showers did you need to take during those 2 weeks? And did you end up with dry skin?
I definitely did some deep breathing
exercises. Yeah, I can imagine. 2 weeks digging through the cesspool of the far right and the Pepe Mem crowd. I don't know if I could do it. I my hat's off. So you mentioned two obvious ties. I would think that the third would be Islamophobia. You know, a significant share of the Muslim American community are first and second generation immigrants. African Americans make up a large share of the Muslim community. I would think that would be the third kind of tie that binds.
Yeah, it is. It's part of this idea of defending Western civilization. There's obviously a racial component to it. It's the red letter. It's that sort of it's the same approach to the president of the United States making a huge media campaign out of the fact that there are some unauthorized immigrants who commit crimes, including horrible crimes.
Right.
But it's that very misleading and false logic that, you know, you can find one or two examples and therefore tar an entire group of people, and that is classic racism, and that is also a classic step towards the ultimate dehumanization of a group of people. And so absolutely that that hatred of Islam and of individual Muslims is very strong in these in the ideas and the content that you see here, and particularly what's very scary about it is there's a repetition of this idea that Islam is not a religion,
right?
And that, you know, Tony Perkins has said this explicitly himself. He has said that Islam is not a— here's the step of logic, okay? One, he'll say Islam is not a religion. Two, it's a political movement and ideology. Three, it therefore is not protected by the First Amendment.
Yes, this is an old piece of logic from Islamophobes, that it's not a religion. And ironically, it is projected to be the world's largest religion by mid-century. It's interesting, you know, the Plus ça change, plus ça même shows. There was a really interesting piece in Politico by Randall Balmer a few years ago. He's a historian at Dartmouth, and he said, look, the evangelical right did not organize in response to Roe v. Wade, as they would have you tell. That's a— as they would have you believe, that's kind of like a mythology. Mm. It was really busing and segregation that was the rallying cry around which the evangelical right came together in the late 70s and early 80s. Mm. Sharona, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really lovely to speak with you too.
Folks, Sharona's piece is called New Analysis Shows Supporters of Family Research Council Embrace White Supremacy and Neo-Nazism. You can find it at rewire.news. That used to be RH Reality Check. Stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland. This is Politics and Reality Radio. You know, Steve Bannon, who is either an evil genius or a lightweight huckster, depending on who you ask, and maybe somewhere in between, has pledged to challenge, to support primary challenges against every Republican senator who's up for in the cycle, except for Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz is apparently wing nutty enough, I guess, for Steve Bannon. Steve says that he is challenging Republicans who are insufficiently supportive of Donald Trump's agenda, and also backing primary challengers who say that they will oppose Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and also backing primary challengers who are willing to get rid of the filibuster. So it's interesting because he says this is all for Donald Trump's sake, but of course Donald Trump needs those Republican senators to pass his agenda. Anyway, I'm joined now by Eliza Newland Carney. She's a columnist for The American Prospect. She wrote this week a piece at The American Prospect that's at prospect.org titled Bannon's Revolution is About Power and Money. Eliza, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it. So it seems like there is an inherent contradiction here in that Bannon is backing people who, some of whom support Donald Trump's agenda, maybe, but are not necessarily going against lawmakers who Trump opposes. What's going on?
Well, there are a lot of contradictions here, and I think it's worth going back and looking a little more closely at Steve Bannon and his history. You know, at the time that Steve Bannon first joined the White House, the Washington Post did an absolutely great investigation that disclosed the amount of money Bannon had made off all sorts of big Republican donors, conservative donors, during the time that he was producing conservative documentaries. And through a whole network of nonprofit groups and private companies, he managed to raise for himself and his own pocket, about $7 million over a 10-year period. Some of it wasn't evident to other people. You know, this is through nonprofit organizations a lot of times that he got this money. And I think Bannon is really good at enriching himself off the causes that he promotes. I think he's got this nationalist vision and he wants to remake the Republican Party, but I also think he's very good at making money off these things, and he's not the only one.
Yeah, he's not the only one. So you talk about the kind of this phalanx of outside groups, Republican consultants, et cetera, who are kind of swooping in to try to make a buck off of this rift that we see so much about or hear so much about within the Republican Party between the so-called establishment Republicans and these insurgent alt-right group, if you will. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, this is not the first time we've seen this, Josh. We saw this with the Tea Party. You know, there was this grassroots Tea Party movement that sprung up, and then all these Beltway organizations like Freedom Partners and Club for Growth basically capitalized on the small donors that were financing the Tea Party and portrayed themselves as Tea Party groups, and their heads made a lot of money off the Tea Party movement. And I'm not saying that they're not committed to reducing taxes. I'm sure they're very ideologically committed. But it's just worth noting that the people who run these groups do happen to make a ton of money off their inflammatory emails. So, you know, this is a little bit of a redux, if you will, of that. The only difference is that we're no longer simply calling for the end of big government and for tax reduction. We're now calling for things that are really deeply threatening to democracy, such as preventing immigrants from entering the country and possibly even advancing a kind of white nationalist agenda. So it's really interesting and disturbing. It would be disturbing to me if I were a Republican to see that these groups really don't, frankly, have the interests of the GOP at heart. In some cases, they're just out to line their own pockets.
Yeah, it really does seem like a grift, especially when you look at the reality that Bannon is backing a number of challengers to really senators who have supported Donald Trump's agenda and who may be amenable to getting rid of the filibuster. And it's, you know, there's so much money. Have you ever fantasized about starting some sort of right-wing super PAC?
Actually, it's so funny because, you know, when the whole super PAC phenomenon first took off after the Citizens United ruling, there were a lot of people who wanted to start super PACs. You know, a lot of super PACs kind of started up. They were just like, wow, I could run a super PAC too. And some of them were college students, and some of them were people who had never been involved in politics. And they actually realized it's harder than it looks. You know, you cannot just scoop up money off super PACs. But if you have an agenda that swings either to the far right or the far left, you have a lot easier time. And it's kind of a reflection of what we see in the media universe, too. You know, especially Fox News and talk radio. I'm not saying these people aren't conservative and don't believe what they're espousing, but they're sure making a lot of money off it. And the more sensational and sort of divisive and crazy it is, the more money that they make. So, you know, I do think that there's a kind of a sense in which Republicans are living with the consequences of a system that they created, especially in the campaign finance arena. You know, it was the GOP that basically said, we shall never have and we should not have any restriction on any nonprofit group or any super PAC ever. And, you know, that's really empowered a lot of forces that are frankly now out of their control.
You know, I would say that that's right more broadly in the sense that they've created a system where there is effectively an alternative establishment in terms of fundraising for campaigns, et cetera, et cetera. These outside groups have pushed them to take maximalist positions that are both unpopular and difficult to achieve. They've been a huge thorn in the side of those in Congress who want to actually pass laws. Paul Ryan's and Mitch McConnell's have had an enormous headache from these outside groups that, you know, have this take no prisoners agenda, et cetera, et cetera. In an earlier era, they could have eclipsed those voices with money, basically, with help with campaign financing, et cetera, et cetera. Those levers of control in the party establishment have largely been at least undermined by this flood of outside money and all these other groups. Did you catch Karl Rove's piece in the Wall Street Journal?
Yes, I really appreciated that story. And I think that it really underscored the way in which Bannon is really speaking out of two sides of his mouth. You know, on the one hand, he says he wants to help Trump by getting rid of people who don't support Trump. On the other, if you really look at these challengers, they're taking on incumbents who actually have largely supported Trump. And again, it goes back to the big donors, because the two people that Bannon currently has already in his corner are Robert and Rebecca Mercer, who are these, I'm sure you know, billionaire conservative funders of far-right causes, including Breitbart, which, of course, Bannon heads. And one of the commentaries I read was so incisive in commenting that the reason that Bannon left Cruz off his hit list is because the Mercers love him. So it's just a demonstration of how it's really the donors who call the tune. And to some degree, you do see that currently in the GOP leadership as well. Some of the things that they're pushing for, including in this tax reform plan, are really things that their big donors want and that average Republican voters don't want. I would say the same for health care reform. You know, average Republican voters actually believe in the Medicare system, and Republicans want to dismantle this partly because that's what their big donors want. So they've kind of backed themselves into a corner.
I agree wholeheartedly. And anyway, this piece by Karl Rove is really interesting. Karl Rove, of course, a voice of the so-called establishment. By the way, I think establishment is kind of a fuzzy term. There are multiple power centers within these broad coalitions we call the major parties. But he writes that Bannon is backing these kind of crackpot candidates. Michael Grimm, the representative who just got out of prison, he was, after being found guilty of tax fraud, he also threatened to kill a reporter on camera. There's another challenger who was who held a hearing. This is the woman who is challenging Jeff Flake. I forget her name. She held a hearing on chemtrails.
That was Carrie Ward, yeah.
Carrie Ward, right. Danny Tarkanian in Nevada against Dean Heller. He's like this, he's lost so many races. It's hard to keep track. And the interesting thing about this is, again, this is supposed to help Trump. Not only is he forcing all of these Republicans to spend money defending themselves in a primary, but if any of these people happen to unseat those elected officials, now you're talking about open races, whereas there is a great advantage to incumbency. Like, I think, I don't know the exact number, but maybe 80% of incumbents are reelected. It's much lower when you're talking about a race between two challengers. So here he's really, really undermining, to the degree he's successful, he's going to undermine Republicans' chances of increasing their margins in Congress and holding on to their majorities. And it's interesting, you talk about the Mercers on one side and other far-right funders. There is now this kind of rift between deep-pocketed conservative groups with the Mercers and people like Foster Fleece. People, I don't know if folks remember Foster Fleece. He was the one who said you don't need birth control. You put an aspirin between your knees and hold them together. He was a backer of Rick Santorum. He almost single-handedly backed Rick Santorum's 2012 candidacy. On one side, and then you have on the other side, you have like the Koch brothers, Chamber of Commerce, all of these groups that these deep-pocketed donors and deep-pocketed groups that are kind of supporting incumbents against these upstarts on the other side. Are the Mercers white supremacists? What do you think is motivating them to back all of these challenges?
Boy, you know, I would love to learn more about the Mercers, and there certainly be people who have written about them. One thing I do know about them, and I would hesitate to call anyone a white supremacist without knowing more about them. I don't know if I could say that about the Mercers, but they're supporting a news organization, which is a, sort of a platform for the alt-right. And they've also supported a lot of books that have been highly critical of Hillary Clinton, and which arguably sort of trafficked in myth and story, yes, to promote far-right agendas. So, yeah, I mean, the Mercers have probably not done a lot to advance civil discourse in the United States. Let's admit, at a minimum, we'll say that, right?
Yes, that is putting it subtly. That is putting it conservatively. I appreciate your disinclination to call them out as white supremacists, even though I will certainly go there. Eliza Newland Carney, I want to thank you so much for taking the time. I believe we are out of time, but I really do appreciate it.
Thank you. It was great talking with you.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and I'll be right back with John Amato from Crooks and Liars. Thank you. Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I am still Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by John Amato. John is a rock star, actually, and also the founder of Crooks and Liars, the excellent video blog. John, thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
My pleasure, Josh.
So I was reading this article in Politico. It was about how Trump has basically inverted the script of social issues. Traditionally, you think conservatives, they run on social issues to rile up their base, get them out to vote. And then when they get into office, those issues are, A, hard to legislate without running afoul of the Constitution. And, you know, it's not exactly what the funders put you in there for. So they run on these social issues, they run to inflame the base, and then they turn towards, you know, deregulation, tax cuts, etc. And this Politico article said, well, this is the reverse with Trump. He actually doesn't care about those substantive policies. He's just really intent on keeping up these stupid fights he has with everybody. And then in recent days, he's launched these ludicrous attacks on, he has found himself or ended up in attacks on Gold Star families once again. This is the second time. And they're supposed to be, you know, inviolate. The right fetishizes military service. What is going on here?
Right. You know, there are no norms anymore for Donald Trump. I mean, the main reason I think that he focuses on cultural issues because he doesn't need any kind of introspection, any kind of examination. He doesn't need to have experts come to the White House and talk about policy and give him advice. And Trump, and then Trump would then, you know, well, let me read this article or this book on economic policy, on the health care bill. I mean, basically, the man that led the birthers is interested in one thing, you know, and he tapped into the white grievance policies that the I call them the conservarazzi have been using for, you know, since Rush Limbaugh, you know, got his total dominance in 1986. And he just capitalized on that hatred that the right instilled in lots of working class people during Obama's presidency, because what they made it about was not about anything but really about his blackness. And if you remember, I mean, there were a lot of black leaders that were really angry at Obama because he didn't do enough to help the African American community. But if you turn on Fox News, every story is that Obama is taking your money and give it to the black and brown people.
Yes.
That was basically their whole argument. And then, you know, obviously it morphed into other things. But for 8 years, they played that up. And then Trump comes in and says, you know, all these Mexicans, all these brown people are rapists that are coming over the borders. You know, they're ISIS sleeper agents. And these people that have been fed this white grievance thing just exploded and went crazy. And, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and I grew up in Queens, where, I mean, I haven't lived there now in a number of years, but Donald Trump was considered a buffoon, you know, a silver spoon jackass who was just chasing skirts. And so at first I didn't give him a chance because he was just so bombastic and really disgusting. But he tapped into that grievance, and that's the only thing he knows, again, because how hard is it? What do you have to prepare to call somebody Little Marco or, you know, Wacky, you know, Wacky Wilson?
It's easier to watch Fox and Friends than to read a briefing paper.
Well, you know, he needs this ego boost every day.
Yes.
It's really quite, it's insane. I mean, there's so many adjectives that I use. I have to keep going and finding new words to describe what I'm writing because we write so much. And it is disturbing that this man is in office, first of all. But, you know, when you look at his history, I mean, he was a jackass when he was in school as a child, right? And he was always a maniacal egomaniac.
Yes.
And his policies, if you go and look on YouTube for, like, really old things, he says the same thing 40 years ago as he says today.
Except when he was in favor of single payer health care and praised Canada's health care system. Policy wise, he was pro choice. He has shifted on certain things in order to make himself appealing.
Exactly,
to the conservative
movement.
He's
always talked about trade deals.
And he's always been a racist because we have the Central Park Five.
And he's always been a racist.
Yeah.
But you know, he hasn't learned, you know, ever to try to get some policy advice because he doesn't have the attention for it. He could care less because, as he says, I just use my gut, you know.
Yeah.
So when the people of Guam are like taking cover because he's threatening North Korea of entire, you know, to annihilate them, and we have 200,000, you know, Americans in different, you know, territories and countries, and they're freaking out because this guy is threatening nuclear devastation.
It's unbelievable. There was a piece in Foreign Policy this week that people both inside and outside the Pentagon are not worried about a war breaking out with Korea in any kind of normal way. They're worried about a war of words and a miscalculation basically leading into an accidental war. Now that we're talking about military issues, let me switch tacks just a little bit. What does it say about our media? Let me stipulate that I believe that nobody in our government, whether they're right-wingers or left-wingers, wants troops to die. What does it say about the fact that Niger, these four special operatives were killed? The military is investigating whether they're doing a probe as to why the intelligence was insufficient, whether they had the proper amount of protection, et cetera, et cetera. What does it say about our media that this is just kind of going unremarked? And, you know, we had Benghazi, it was basically a talking point from Mitt Romney during the campaign. Immediately when he launched that attack, it was condemned by all sides. And then all of a sudden, or over time, I guess, it became an actual issue.
Yeah, you know, it is kind of stunning and interesting because, let's face it, whoever president who's ever in office, you know, when there's some sort of a special op that goes wrong, it was never something that then became, you know, attack the other side for all his problems. It was a military operation, and you would have treated accordingly.
Right. It was a tragedy. It's a tragedy.
Well, exactly.
These things
and that's
are
really
tragedies.
What it is. So, you know, can you blame, you know, President Bush? I mean, we could blame a lot of things of President Bush, but if someone attacked an embassy or a safe house or stuff, I mean, you know, things happen in the field, you know? I mean, intelligence isn't perfect that you'll know everything that everybody does. So things are going to happen. I mean, you know, could you imagine when Reagan, when our embassy and our station got, we lost, what, 240 servicemen in
bombing?
In Beirut,
truck bombing, yes.
Can you imagine what would be, you know, in today's world, what would have happened?
Well, let me just remind you that what immediately after the truck bombing, what did Reagan do? He literally cut and run and withdrew all those troops.
Right, and he pulled them right out because he knew it was an unstable place. I mean,
imagine if a Democrat did that.
Oh my God, he's weak. I mean, that's all you heard of him was just weak, even though he ran on the idea of withdrawing troops, of trying to not get us into more, you know, lying us back into wars. So it's stunning now that any kind of a, you know, operation is a political football. But it's really interesting about the Niger case, the Niger, however you would like to pronounce it, is that the media and the administration said nothing about it. And I think, you know, see, Trump stirs up so much insanity with his personal attacks on everybody that it does shift the media's narrative because you can't even understand what he's saying, and then you have to take it seriously. You have to cover it. This is the president of the United States. He's on Twitter calling every news organization fake news except for, you know, Fox News, and Sean Hannity's my best friend, and he gets counsel from, you know, every Fox News analyst. You have to cover this daily because he's the president.
Yes.
And it's, you know, and so I remember, you know, reading about what had happened in Niger, but it was like Mike Barnicle who brought it up, I think, on Morning Joe when he accosted a Trump apologist, congressman, and said, like, why is Trump tweeting about the NFL and ESPN hosts and hasn't said one word about this tragedy? And the guy immediately, you know, as is the one with the Kellyanne Conway talking point, is to don't answer the question, deflect, attack, and then blame the media.
Right.
Right? And call you un-American. They don't answer the questions. And we'll talk about Sarah Huckabee Sanders' presser from before, which was just unbelievable. And so, you know, it sort of started percolating up, our site. I started writing about it. And people were asking, like, why isn't he? It was just odd because he sends out so many tweets a day about everything, and he wraps himself around the flag. You know, this guy's taken, you know, his presidency is really jingoism in
play. Yeah, on steroids.
It's unbelievable.
On steroids. And let me just point out one other thing.
Yeah.
One of the corpses of one of the special forces operators sat out in the desert for 2 days and before it was found and recovered. This is the type of visceral story that the right would be losing their minds over if this was under a Democratic administration. They left that trooper out in the desert to rot for 2 days before they recovered the body. It would be such a prime Fox fodder, right? We would never hear the end of it. It would be an absolute...
It would be a conspiracy, like, what are they doing in Africa?
Exactly.
And I think
right.
It was the Nigerian troops that actually found the body, and that was the body of LeDavid Johnson, who basically Trump started a firestorm about.
With his pregnant widow. It's unbelievable. Well, John, I believe we are out of time. I need to have you back on when we have more time. But I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I do appreciate it.
No problem. I really appreciate coming on. And Mr. Holland, have a great day.
Thanks, sir. I'd also like to thank Sharona Coots and Eliza Newland Carney. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud, wherever else you can find it. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd like to thank Digby, Crooks and Liars, that's John Amato again, and the Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine human beings for tuning in. Have a terrific week.